Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 348. You can't climb the ladder of success with your hands in your pockets. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, my Indie Film Hustlers, to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by MusicBed. As filmmakers, we're always looking for songs and music for our projects, but it's such a pain in the butt to license and go get music, and it's just been a nightmare. But MusicBed has changed all of that. You can download a single song, get unlimited music with a subscription, or even create a custom song or score from scratch. They already have over 20,000 songs, beautifully categorized, and their catalog is growing every single day. If you want to check it out, just go to indiefilmhustle.com/musicbed. And because you are Indie Film Hustle Tribe members, you get 1 month for free to try it out or 20% off a single song purchase. Just enter the promo code Indie Film Hustle. Today's show is also sponsored by Blackmagic Design's DaVinci Resolve. And as many of you have known over the years, DaVinci Resolve is my preferred editing software. I edited my first two features on it. I've edited multi-million dollar shows for Legendary Pictures as well as Hulu and many other projects. It is a workhorse and amazing. It is the only 8K editing software that also has world-class color grading, visual effects, and audio post-production all in one software. And the best thing about it, you can download a copy of it for free. Or you can pay $2.99 to get the full studio package, which is a bargain. If you want to download it, just head over to blackmagicdesign.com. Now, before we get started, guys, I want to let you know that this week I will be announcing that big announcement that I've been promising you. And I'm going to give you a little hint on what it is. It is going to be my first live boot camp. It will be a 2-day intensive and it's going to be intense. I'm going to be jamming a lot of information in those 2 days and it will be held here in Los Angeles. So later this week, I will announce all the details. So stay tuned. Now, today on the show, we have filmmaker Rob Smatt. Now, Rob is a Indie Film Hustle Tribe member, and the podcast and everything I do with Indie Film Hustle really helped guide him through the process of making his first film called The Last Whistle. He started the process when he was 22 years old, and it really is a great example of how to focus on a niche audience, how to create a product, and we just go into a deep dive into his entire process, his distribution strategy, and how he's generating revenue from his film. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Rob Smatt. I'd like to welcome to the show Rob Smatt, man. How you doing, brother?
I am super happy to be here. I'm so excited to talk about this movie. And I mean, I'm a huge time, long time fan and, you know, just thrilled to be here.
I appreciate that, man. I appreciate that. You were telling me earlier off air that that Indie Film Hustle had a little bit to do with helping you make the movie.
A little bit. I mean, it's got everything to do. It's got everything to do with this movie. I started listening to Indie Film Hustle a year or two ago, at least, if not longer. And every episode, it's just like there's something else that I hadn't heard before. There's something else I didn't learn in the film school track. And just so specific to the kind of thing that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And this, I mean, just everything on this podcast was super, super helpful. So, you know, the stuff that I want to, you know, hopefully help everybody with today, I hope mm-hmm. it's going to be very specific. This is going to be Indie Film Hustle, you know, veteran. You know, it's not just going to be, how did you make your movie? It's like, let me tell you about the deal structure of X, Y, and Z. So, I'll, you know, we'll have fun.
I appreciate that, brother. So, all right. So first question, how did you get into the film business?
Good question. I was, you know, I've always been making movies. It's always been something that I've done. And in high school, I got to that point where it was like, all right, am I going to go into science, go into physics, or am I going to chase the arts? And I said, well, let's see where I get into. Let's see how colleges sort out. And I got into USC's film program, as they call it, the Harvard of Film School, mm-hmm. Harvard of Film Schools. It's not, but, you know, it's fun to think.
I know. A little,
you know.
I've been there.
yes, you have. but you know, at that point, it was sort of that idea where it's like, okay, if they let me in, then I guess I'm on par at least. You know, I guess I'm close. And so at that point, I just said, you know what, this is something that I love, and I wanna take a shot at it. And so that was kind of how I, you know, started. And after 4 years of film school, and you know, then spent a few months after, and then started on this movie right after that. And it's been about 2 years since then.
What was the biggest thing you learned in film school, and was it worth it?
That's two separate questions.
Two separate questions.
What I learned was it worth it? So I think I'll answer was it worth it first, because I think the most interesting and worthwhile part of the film school wasn't so much, you know, the classes or the facilities or the things that they kind of like to advertise. Mm-hmm. It was the most valuable part for me was I grew up in Texas. I, you know, spent 18 years of my life in Texas. I, you know, or 15, I, you know, I started there, I grew up there. And especially, you know, 10 years ago, Texas didn't really have a film industry besides Austin. And, you know, I was up in Fort Worth and the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So there wasn't a huge film education thing happening there. The internet, you know, I couldn't really stream YouTube in my house. So, you know, it wasn't happening. And so to be able to go to L.A. and just do a total immersion into Hollywood and the whole shebang was hugely beneficial for me. And the school did a good job of sort of, you know, conveying that and, you know, not giving it to me all at once and, you know, blowing my head up or whatever. So I think that was the biggest value to film school, at least, was that. Mm-hmm. And then the friends I made there, the connections, you know, that half the people on The Last Whistle are USC people. Mm-hmm. And they're all, you know, early 20s. You know, they're not far out of school. They were the people I came up with. And I think the biggest thing that I learned at the school was it doesn't matter when it comes to movie making. It doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how good of a writer you are or what your stats are. It's all about how hard you try. And I think that that's something that Indie Film Hustle is all about. But honestly, you can be in the Harvard of film schools and the valedictorian is no better than number 150 out of 150. But it's all who tries is who actually, you know, I've been happy to work with for sure.
You mean who hustles?
Hustles. That's right. Go back and just edit hustle into everything. Right?
Exactly.
Talk about who hustles. Yeah.
Now, tell me about your film, The Last Whistle.
Okay, so The Last Whistle is a sports drama. It's very much in the vein of Friday Night Lights. We are doing day and date release. It's, you know, of course it's about 90 minutes. It's, you know, a very simple movie, but really tried to, make it exciting and really make it, up the production value as much as I could. It's basically what happens to a coach after one of his players collapses during practice. And so it's a lot of the stuff that I feel like you hear about in the news from time to time, mm-hmm. where a football player or a soccer player or a cross-country runner collapses. I mean, and then they don't know why it happened. Everyone's kind of hurt, you know, shattered by this. And it's super tragic. And so just, you know, I played 4 years, 5 years of football. I played on a championship team in Texas. And going through that and seeing that happen at so many schools and so many different sports around the area, it was something that affected me. And so when it came to this first movie, I started to think, all right, you know, what's something that's scary? What's a good hook? And that was what jumped out at me. That's like, this used to scare my pants off and still does, you know? So do what all the great filmmakers do and make a movie about it.
Yeah, it is a pretty scary topic in general. And I've seen, you know, I remember when I was in high school and had to do with that, you know, they work you. And I was in Florida, so they worked you and the heat and everything. And they think that, you know, because they're 18, they're, you know, they could just keep going and going and going, but they are human.
Yeah, yeah. And there's all sorts of different aspects to it. And you know, I won't put the cart before the horse here, but we did one of our big marketing things that, you know, was totally self-generated was let's get in with the Heart Association. Let's work with some nonprofits that deal with this sort of thing. And so we've really tried to sort of, you know, cross collaborate on those sides of things to, you know, raise awareness about it and actually kind of add a social commentary to the film.
Yeah, so what I find fascinating about your movie and the way you made it, we're going to get more into detail about it, is that you were thinking about this as an entrepreneur. You were thinking about this as a holistic project in many different avenues, as opposed to just, hey, I'm going to make some art. We're going to go do some stuff and we'll see if we can make some money at the end of it. You were actually, you really thought about this, and you actually do a lot of the stuff that I talk about on the podcast, which is like, hey, connect with some people, like, you know, organizations, get into a niche, you know, who are the audiences that you can reach out to, you know, what, who is the demographic for this film? You know, this is obviously, it can range into faith-based, but people who like Friday Night Lights, who people like high school football movies, you know, and then just dramas and things like that. But you really have thought about this, and that's a, it's a great, great example.
I'm telling you, brother, this is Indie Film Hustle, the movie. I mean, every piece of it. I mean, it's partly that. It's a lot of it has to do too with Jason Brubaker, who you've interviewed, mm-hmm. I think, three times at this point, who runs Distribber. And while we didn't end up going distribution through Distribber, Jason's a guy that I admire, and I've met at a couple different things. I did AFM for the first time and saw him there, and you know, all the places that Jason pops up, I've made sure to go and find him. And it's the calculator thing that he talks about, where it's like, figure out how much you're going to make per sale, figure out how many people need to buy the movie, and go find those people. You know, if you get 50 people to buy based on a news article, go, you know, get 100 news articles wherever they are. You know, you got to make these numbers up, because you're only going to get so much from the storefront, you know, and that sort of thing. And so, you know, that's kind of what drove it alongside. It was just, you know, I want to get people through the door. I want to get a lot of people to see this movie. And then I had seen a lot of, you know, I think one of the most common film school movies, and it's not a bad thing, but I think one of the most common first features for a filmmaker, it starts off with three words: coming of age. And whenever I hear those three words, I just think, all right, first feature, you know, that sounds like it to me. And so, and again, there's nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that it's common, that it happens a lot. And so, you know, I nothing with making a good or a bad coming of age movie. But the marketplace for coming of age movies can only handle so many movies. And so I almost look at it as like, I'm walking into a casino, I'm walking up to the roulette table, and, you know, would I rather bet on a color, or am I going to bet on a number? And, you know, for anyone who knows roulette, a number is a 1 in 36 chance, a color 50-50. And so that's kind of the whole idea with this movie, was how do I bet on the colors instead of the numbers? How do I increase our margin for success?
Yeah, it's kind of like the – are you familiar with the blue ocean, red ocean strategies?
No, I'm not.
All right. So the blue ocean, red ocean strategy is based on a book called Blue Ocean, Red Ocean. And it's basically when perfect example, independent film, will go a horror movie. So okay. Let's say it's really affordable. Everyone makes a horror movie, right? Well, that mm-hmm. we consider the horror movie a red ocean. That means that there's blood in the water and there's a lot of competition. You want to go into a blue ocean where there's less competition, or preferably nobody's there. So when you make a faith-based or, you know, football movie at a high production value, the competition for that kind of movie is going to be a lot less. Hence, you can raise your rates, you can raise your money. You make another horror movie, there's a million of those out there. So then now if you're going to do a horror movie, you got to go niche. So like Hatchet. I always loved Hatchet, because Hatchet was like, oh, we're the American slasher movie. So like, and then there's subgenre, like there's torture porn and all these other kind of.
It's Vegan Chef is what it is.
It's the Vegan Chef. It's the Vegan Chef. I've never had someone call me back out to that. I appreciate that.
The second I heard that, I was like, why is there not a required reading for every kid in film school about the Vegan Chef?
The Vegan Chef movie. I have to make the vegan. I've spoken about the Vegan Chef.
And I think part of it too is, I mean, again, I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but a lot of The Last Whistle was, what's the word for it? Teleological. Teleology, I think, is the word for it. And it's all about the study of ends. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a teleologist, you study the apocalypse, you study, you know, you study the end of the world, you study these things. And so on a smaller scale, The Last Whistle was totally reverse engineered. It was, I want a movie that distributors will at least be interested in. You know, it doesn't have to go traditional distribution, but I want something that they would be interested in, mm-hmm. something that's marketable, something like you said that feels new, but it's got something old to it. You know, kind of Scott Derrickson's 25-75 is, or 50-50 is what he calls it. And you know, and so it was really that idea of where do I want to be? Not so much, you know, what do I have? It was a little bit of both. Where do I want to be and what do I have at my disposal? And so that was the whole thing, was it was like, you know, the teleology of you know, I want to end up with, you know, something that really changes what people are expecting.
Yeah, you've built a movie. You came at it like a blueprint almost, as opposed to just like, hey, I'm just going to get a whole bunch of wood and some nails and let's see what happens. You actually constructed like, no, I'm not only going to figure out how to build this thing, but I'm going to have a buyer for this thing before I get done with
it. Well, I'll tell you what kicks me into that, and I'm sure, you know, everyone in the tribe will know an experience like this. It was a bad experience, and a bad experience was what showed me, oh, a blueprint's a really good idea. And, you know, I can talk about it, you know, with a light heart, because it wasn't my project. It was just something I was helping out on. And it was a project that we really, you know, if there was a blueprint, I was the one trying to be like, hey, wait, here's, we should blueprint.
And what happened to that one?
Not much. You know, it's not much.
a lot of time and money was wasted.
Whatever you think happened is what happened.
Mistakes were made.
Yeah, I mean, it was at the end of the day, it was a half-built house and a lot of nails and boards that weren't ever going to fit in that house. And you can't sell a half-built house.
No, not in this market.
Yeah, right. 20 years ago, South Korea, videotape, backyard.
They could have, maybe, but not in this market. All right. So how did you raise the money? The budget for this was about how much?
$100,000.
About $100,000. All right. So that's not a micro. It is a micro budget in the grand scheme of things. But for a normal guy like you or I, pulling 100 extra grand out of our pockets it's a bit much. So how did you raise the money?
A lot of different places. I mean, just really had to start a lot of different places. So I think that's such an important question. It's such a crux of what people ask. And I think before I kind of go into it, I think sort of the mindset and the helpful part that you've already kind of hit on was we had the blueprint whenever we were going out for financing. And so we had this blueprint of, all right, here's what the independent film landscape looks like. You know, here's where our film is a micro budget film. And then here's where we can lose money if we do it wrong. You know, we were very forthcoming with the investors saying, here's what we're worried about and here's how we're going to try to mitigate that. So I think the blueprint was the biggest piece of that. The blueprint was, you know, $100,000 is not a little, but it's not so much that we can, get caught off balance, you know, overcommit, you know, spend too much. I had researched a couple other films. I mean, I've been following, like, Thunder Road is a film I've been following very closely, not in the sense that we're the same as them in any way. I mean, they really did a good job with the festival circuit and knew their audience, and we have very different audiences. But I followed them, and I followed them in terms of, okay, how much money have they been able to get with the resources they had? You know, how did their storefront deliver? And then I just started calling up other directors, and I'd say, hey, how much money have you made? You know, I mean, and they, you know, never in a way where it was like, give me an exact number, but it was always, how did iTunes go for you? How did Amazon go for you? Did you get a streaming deal? How much was that worth? And, you know, of course, listening to your guests on the show. And so it's very hard. It's very hard to get those numbers. The Creative Institute at Sundance is trying to make that a little more transparent. And they're awesome in that way. I mean, I'm so excited to see all the stuff that they continue to put out. But I kind of was able to go into investors with those numbers and say, hey, here's what the numbers look like. Here are your odds of success. Here's how we're going to try to increase those. We went to production companies. You know, we went to some B-level groups, and a lot of them said that, you know, it's you guys don't have any prior work. You know, you're all just out of film school, and even though it's USC, it's not enough for us to feel confident in. And that's just the way it goes. And we were expecting that, so we went to, I think we're between 8 different private investors. Very spread out, you know, none of them feeling too like it's, you know, no one cashed in all of grandma's retirement savings or anything like that, which was good. And we each one of them had a different ask, and one or two of them just were wanting to be a part of it. And the whole goal was, what can I do for you? You know, this is a movie. You don't normally invest in movies, but, you know, if this excites you, we want to work with you on it. And that was kind of how we built the financing.
Now, what you were talking earlier a little bit about the budget levels, like a $10,000 movie, a $50,000 movie, a $100,000 movie. What is the difference in your eyes on the difference, so, obviously, besides financial?
I think that there and I'm sure you know this, but I think there's a huge difference in the 100,000 and under range that indie filmmakers don't realize. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of indie filmmakers who spend $100,000 on a movie that should have cost 10. Yeah. And that's a lot of indie filmmakers spend 10 on a movie that really needed 100. And then in the end, you've got 50, and then in the middle, you've got 50, and those filmmakers can go both ways, and both, you know, budgets can go towards those filmmakers. And I think that, you know, whatever your budget is, you should really know, I mean, where you're going to spend money, where you're not going to spend money, you know, that can get pretty complicated. But I think that one of the biggest things that I see, and I'm sure you've seen too, is at these lower budget levels, filmmakers feel like they have to do everything in one location. Mm-hmm. They feel like it has to be a bottle episode. It has to take place in one location. And I think that you can really shoot yourself in the foot when you do that. That was something I was really excited about with The Last Whistle, was we have, 15 locations minimum in the film. I mean, this movie travels. You don't feel like you're in one place the whole time. And the fear always is, well, we've only got this amount of money, so we can't afford a company move. We can't afford the time it takes to go from one place to another. But I think you increase the production value of your movie so much if you can add some other locations in there.
Yeah, without question.
Yeah, and I think 10,000 is the only budget level where you can say, you know what, let's keep it in one place. You know, or maybe if you're in the 100,000, 50,000 range, but it's an action movie and you're dealing with stunts or controlled, explosives or something like that. Like, okay, I can see needing to stay in one location for something like that. But the single location movie has been done so frequently that you can risk losing hundreds of thousands of dollars if you feel like that's the way you have to do it. And so that's sort of the thing that I've seen is, if you're gonna spend six digits on a movie, try not, don't do it in one place unless you absolutely, it's mandated by the script, I think is the way that I would put that.
Yeah, I mean, and with my film, my last film, On the Corner of Ego and Desire, we did that for about 3,000, but it was done at the Sundance Film Festival. But the thing was that there was tremendous amount of production value, and every 5 minutes we're moving. We're somewhere else. We're moving here. So it actually had probably like 20 locations when it was all said and done.
Yeah.
So it added a tremendous amount of production value to do that kind of film.
That's how we use. So we shot, kind of the next question is, how'd you do it? How'd you, keep the production value low? We shot at my high school. I called them up. I said, hey, listen, I know there's a week where the students aren't in class and it's not a holiday or anything like that. Do you mind if we shoot there as long as we've got our, location insurance, pay the security guards overtime, that sort of thing? And they were super awesome. They were super awesome inviting. And it kind of played into, okay, I know how many families are at this high school who would watch this movie. So here's another audience that we can use. And this high school was awesome because it gave us everything from offices to the football field, to the locker room. And it kind of turned into this mini, not the soundstage, but it turned into like a studio lot in a way. And so we would have a quote unquote company move, but we were moving from building A to building B.
Sure.
But you still feel like it's a whole new place as long as you hide it with production design, essentially.
Yeah, that's the same thing happened with us. We were just constantly moving to different locations throughout the whole piece. And it was literally a block away or literally, next door. But it seems like, boom, it's like this entire new world. And that's the key. I think I've done that with a bunch of my movies where I've been in one location, but I can probably get 20 looks, 20 scenes that are completely distinctive. And makes it feel much larger than it is, but it really was just like, let's just walk down the hall, and it's like a completely new world. So yeah, that's great. And anytime you can get a location like a high school, which you have complete control over, you can create a ton of production value because there is a ton of production value there.
Mm-hmm. Without question, it's all about just make the. I think the hardest part is don't do it in LA. I think that's
when it comes to
challenging locations. they will they'll ask for your checkbook minute one when you're in LA. Oh, but if you're outside of LA and you've got a personal connection somehow and you not only say you're not going to damage anything, but you actually do it. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's another thing too, where it's like, you need to know everyone on your crew and you need to make sure that while yes, you as the director or producer or writer will respect the space, that your gaffer will respect the space. And
you're
not going to do something with a C stand and, you know, and that was, you know, I was the last one on set every day cleaning up, you know, water bottles.
Absolutely.
And everyone was like, well, we're coming back first thing in the morning and they're not going to be here overnight. So who cares? And I was like, I care. God forbid the person that, you know, let us use this room comes to find all these water bottles everywhere. Like I want them to like us when we leave.
So in other words, you weren't wearing your ascot and your monocle with a blowhorn as a director?
Well, I put the monocle in my front pocket and then I cleaned up the water, you know, and then I put it.
Then you put it back out and then the ascot's there all the time generally just because it's.
I mean, you can clean sweat with it. It's the ascot is multifunctional. Works very well with the Hawaiian shirt too, which
I've never seen an ascot with a Hawaiian shirt that I have not seen yet. Now, how did you get your talent? You have a fairly, great cast.
Sure. So the hardest part with the talent, I thought, was going to be the money. I thought the hardest thing was going to be, you know, we've got this movie, we're attaching talent, we have, you know, I thought the hardest thing to say was going to be, we're not done with the investment yet. You know, we're not done getting the money yet. We started casting with probably 40 to 50% of our investment in the bank. And so I thought that was going to be the hurdle, but no one asks to see your bank account. No one demands, you know, you put a cashier's check into them for the most part. I mean, unless you're getting too high for who you should be going after.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really realized was the hardest thing was, you know, as long as they like the script, which is huge, as you know. That if you have what you would call a bulletproof screenplay,
mm-hmm.
you've been hustling on that screenplay,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
they will read it and they'll say, this is a great thing for me. I love this role. You know, and if they genuinely love the role, they will play ball with you. There are actors who will say, oh, I love the role. It's so well written. But, you know, they're just saying that, you know.
You mean no in L.A.? No, stop it. Stop it. You mean they're not telling you the truth?
Tampa,
anywhere. Texas, anywhere.
So you have to have that to start off with. If you don't have that, then, you know, that's why you're not getting calls back, I think, when it comes to attaching talent. But the second thing is they want to know your prior work, just like the production companies did. And again, with this movie, you know, I didn't have a football movie that I had made before this. You know, this was going to be the football movie. You know, I didn't have some award winning short film because, you know, to make a really good short film these days, it money helps. And I didn't want to go and spend 10 to 20K on something that I knew couldn't earn its money back. Mm-hmm. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing that, especially if you're aware of that going into it. But I that's just not my style. You know, I don't think I'm good at shorts, honestly. I think features are really where I'm comfortable. Mm-hmm. So the hard thing was not having prior work to show the talent, the agents, the managers, the gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
What we did have was a sizzle reel. I had gone to my little brother's homecoming football game. I filmed some stuff in slow motion, threw some Friday Night Lights soundtracks over it. Mm-hmm. And there was our, you know, last whistle sizzle reel. And
that's awesome.
It was enough. It wasn't perfect. No one was like, oh, you guys know how to make movies. But it was, I feel something. This makes me feel something. And so I'm interested. It was not shot beautifully. There was this production design was terrible, but they felt something. And that was just like a trailer, the what you have to do when you want to convert someone to your side.
I was going to ask you to touch on the sizzle reel stuff, though. That's something that a lot of filmmakers don't understand about sizzle reels. It's like in creating a sizzle reel, it's an inexpensive way to really give a feeling, a look, a vibe to your project. And it really makes people who are generally not very visual, especially financiers, they can't think visually. So if you show them something, even if it's a cut up, you use other movies and cut up a fake trailer for your movie with Brad Pitt in it. I mean, and you're not saying that Brad Pitt's going to be in it, but I've seen it done and I've cut it. It's kind of like a feel, a vibe. I'm like, this is just a vibe. We don't have Mr. Pitt.
Have you cut sizzle reels for clients?
Many times. Cool. Back in the day. I used to cut sizzle reels. It was VHS. But back in the day, I would cut together. You know, I remember doing scenes from Seven and some, you know, a bunch of, you know, kind of serial killer, dark, dingy Fight Club kind of vibes to put together for a project that had that kind of energy to it. And they wanted it just, it's, you know, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 seconds tops. So that's one way of doing it. Then shooting something like what you did, which was kind of like a sizzle reel. You actually shot footage, but you put in copywritten music as a demo is
fine.
And
that's almost as good as Brad Pitt. I mean, you the fact that you can go to a music library and pull anything. I mean, everyone loves the score to
Friday Night Lights.
Inception. I mean, that's on everything.
Shawshank Redemption as well. That Shawshank Redemption soundtrack is on. You could literally insert Shawshank Redemption's music on almost any movie and it will just take it up to that next level.
I've used
it so many times on so many different reels and things. You're just like, god damn it, man, that's just a good score.
And so I think all of this is circumventing the obvious answer, which is you should get a casting director to do all this for you. You know, where's your casting director? And I don't
have the budget.
Even going into this project, I didn't realize how expensive a really good casting director was.
Brutal.
And they earn every penny of it. I mean, because they do amazing work and they deal with the agents and the managers. They can get the talent to feel comfortable with you. So it was in the absence of that we were, and we did end up having a casting director who was awesome and brought in Brad Leland at the end and brought in Deanne Levine at the end. But they worked more locally, and then they helped us go for our lead, which we still didn't have at that point. So I'm talking more about when we started by attaching Jim O'Hare, who we all know is Jerry from Parks and Rec. Mm-hmm. And I had been keeping up with Jim and his career since Parks and Rec, because like him, like Aubrey Plaza, like a lot of the actors in The Office too, you know, I'd watched those ensemble shows for so long and had really been able to figure out which members of the ensemble had this amazing, like, star-studded talent. And I'm almost bummed that Aubrey Plaza's blown up in the way that she has, because I knew she was there. But luckily, you know, Jim wasn't, you know, his schedule wasn't full like hers was. And so we started with Jim, and we sort of packaged it like you would at an agency. I started with my friends who I knew were kind of on the cusp of, you know, TV stardom. Then they talked to their friends. We brought in some of our executive producers, Eric and Sainty, are fantastic, and they have hit that TV stardom and the movie stardom. And so they had friends that they were able to go to. And so it was those personal connections and then showing who we had cast already laid a really nice groundwork when it came to casting folks without a casting director and without prior work.
You know, it's funny, just to go back on the sizzle reel, do you know what Robert Rodriguez did for El Mariachi?
No.
All right. So when he was pimping out El Mariachi around town, he had his short film Bedhead on a VHS. Then he had cut a trailer for Mariachi. But what he did was he took the soundtrack of another trailer, because in those days they didn't do a lot of dialogue. It was just all music and Roger Ebert gives it 5-4, you know, 2 thumbs up, that kind of stuff. Action packed all the way, says, you know, Peter Travers from Rolling Stone.
Don't forget the zooms. You have like the zoom to the face, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So he just took that soundtrack and edited his movie off the soundtrack. So when someone saw it, they were like, well, this looks like a real movie. It was pretty genius. It's things that I used to do back in the day when I was doing my demo reels. But he took it to another place with his feature. But yeah, sizzle reels are very powerful.
The funny thing that you mentioned, Robert Rodriguez did the Rebel Without a Crew competition on El Rey.
Yes.
You had two.
I've had one, Alejandro, and then I've met with Josh. I was on his podcast, and now I'm going to have him on my podcast in the next few months.
So I loved that show. I watched every episode.
I did too. It's the best one. It's the best one of all of those shows.
It definitely, because Greenlight is just, you know, Greenlight's got its own stuff.
Hey man, I was in season two. I was in season two of Project Greenlight. 5 seconds opening credits.
Very nice. Rebel Without a Crew, the TV show, was, you know, most people say their first feature was genocized by the book.
Robert.
Yeah. But, you know, the Rebel Without a Crew, the TV show, was what made me go and write The Last Whistle. And so I initially wrote this as a $7,000 feature.
How could you do this for $7,000? That must have been, been impossible.
I would go and shoot during the home. I would make the sizzle reel all the football that was in the movie. And then I would shoot the coach at his home, getting phone calls from people and getting visited by people.
Okay, it'd be a different movie.
Yeah, it's similar, but it cuts out all the other characters, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's total art house instead of, you know, sports with like a twinge of art house, which is, I think, what Les was trying to be. But anyway, that was the genesis of this project. And that's kind of what they told me was, how would you do this for $7,000? And I was like, you don't know me. Like, just give me a shot. And they picked who they did. And I thought Alejandro especially killed it on that show. I found it so funny how on this third or fourth episode, he was telling the other filmmakers what gear to go grab from the cart. You know, they had like the cart or whatever. Yeah. He's like, no, you don't need a C-stand. Like get the light, you know. And so I thought that was hilarious.
And his new movie coming out, Millennium Bugs, is coming out soon. I saw his trailer, dude. It looks awesome, dude. And he made it for like under 100, and it looks great. Looks really, really great.
Good for him. Anyway, that was the genesis of The Last Whistle. And they turned it down, and when they did, I said, let's go make it ourselves.
Fantastic, man. Now, you also reached out to distributors before shooting.
I did.
Wow, amazing.
That was another one of your episodes. I don't know which one it was, but I'm sure it was – I don't remember who that was. But, you know where I got that idea.
Yeah. So you went out to a distributor. You talked to them and like, look, I'm making a football movie. What do you need in here? How did that process go?
Just like casting, more difficult than I expected. It was kind of crazy how few distributors would email me back and how few of them would actually reply to someone who's essentially a future customer, you know, someone who's going to go and do all the legwork for them. You know, I mean, I was kind of shocked that these very middle level distribution companies were not paying me the time of day to just pick up the phone for 10 minutes.
Shocking. You know? Shocking.
Shocking. So here I am just with my lofty ideals for humanity. And maybe well,
you're in the wrong business for that, my friend. I hate to tell you.
Try San Diego, I guess.
But you got a few to call you back.
Eventually, yeah. So eventually, Josh Spector at Gravitas at the time said, I'll give you 10 minutes, you know, as long as you're not trying to sell me the movie. You know, I'd go through the usual channels for that. And I was like, no, it's not like we don't need pre-sales. We don't need this stuff. Just, you know, 10 minutes is perfect. And Josh was nice enough to pick up the phone and tell me, you know what, just you're doing football. Make sure it's got a ton of football, especially in the first 5 minutes. Make sure that your key art and your onset photography is excellent. We need a lot of options when it comes to art. He said, you know, make sure that you've got very high production value enough to where you can cut a really good trailer with. And he just talked about, you know, the make sure that if you have a lot of football, the football is forefront. If you end up getting a big actor, that they are front and center. But I think the main question I went into Josh with was, I said, here's our budget and we're not sure if we're going to get a big actor. Can we make it work? And he said, if it's football, you can make it work. If it's not, it won't. You know, a drama that's made for 100K, I don't think will make its money back. No. And I'm paraphrasing that those aren't his, you know, his opinions or beliefs or anything that has to do with where he is now, which is vertical entertainment. But that was the gist of kind of what he told me and his publicly available knowledge. And eventually he phoned me back, emailed me back about 5 or 6 months later and said, hey, did you guys finish the movie? You know, Vertical would love to take a look at it. And at that point, that's where the ball started rolling. And he ended up being our acquisitions. He acquired us. So
isn't it funny? So you mean to tell me, I got to lay this out for everybody listening.
Yeah.
So you mean to tell me that you call up a distributor and go, hey, I just want 10 minutes of your time. I'm thinking about we're going to go make this movie. I would love to hear your thoughts on what we need to make this movie sellable and marketable for you and with your wealth of experience and years of experience. And then he was impressed enough with you that called you back or emailed you back 5 or 6 months later and said, hey, whatever happened to that football movie? I'm over at this new place and why don't you come over here? And then that turns into your distribution deal.
Yeah,
pretty much it. Shocking. It's amazing what happens when you actually just do this kind of stuff. Like it's one thing. Look, I preach about this stuff every day, all the time, but it's just very few people who want to do the legwork. And because if not, this is what would have happened. You would have made your movie and what? You would have then tried to make your movie and then you would have started calling everybody and then you would have gotten all sorts of horrible deals if anyone would have called you back. And you would just like, you would be rolling the dice. You would be betting on the number, not on the color, basically. Exactly. You're trying to stack the odds against for you as much as you can against the house.
I think there's an interesting thing when it comes to film festivals. I think this is a good point to throw.
That was my next question.
So my thesis going into this movie, you know, I did have some theses going into this movie. I said, I think this will work. Here's the evidence, and then let's test it out. Let's do the scientific, you know, the scientific process with it. And so my thesis going into this was, film festivals have way too much bearing on the sellability of a film. People put way too much weight on a festival
because of the 90s. They actually did have power. You know, Sundance. You won Sundance. You got that check from Harvey. Yeah, I know he's not a cool name to say right now, but you got that name. You got Miramax to show up.
I would cash that check. If you get a check from Harvey now, I would make sure that doesn't bounce.
Exactly. But back then, I mean, there was probably around a 6 or 7 year period that festivals were powerful, you know, and some still are, of course. I mean, you win Toronto, you win Cannes, you win, you know, maybe Tribeca or you win South by. That does bring in certain amounts, but that's such a small amount of films.
And so my thing was, okay, we're a Texas film. Should we try it? Should we wait until March to go for South by?
Right.
And in the end, we didn't apply to South by. We didn't apply to Sundance. I wanted to keep it grassroots. I wanted to go where I knew the numbers were, where I knew that we had the 50-50 odds instead of the 1 in 36. And so we debuted at the Lone Star Film Festival in Fort Worth, where we filmed it. And we had a huge opening night crowd, lots of local press. And what we did there was we started our audience. I mean, you know, we started building our audience there. And we got to do that in November instead of March. Whereas if we had gotten into South by and done March, we would have had to wait until football season 2021 to get the movie out there because mm-hmm. you can't release this movie in, you know, the winter time. It's got to be football season.
Sure.
And so that was again, that teleological thinking about the end, you know, really trying to land the plane 100 miles away instead of, you know, just slamming down on the runway, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so that was my thesis going into it. Now, I think an interesting thing that I will be the first to admit is what I was wrong about was the same thesis that I had about a name for a movie. You know, my mm-hmm. thesis when it comes to names is a name does not guarantee you a good movie in any way. And on mm-hmm. top of that, a name does not guarantee you money, as we saw with not Manchester by the Sea, but was it By the Sea, the Brad Pitt, Jolie?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the one that Angelina, I think she wrote and directed that one. Yeah,
she did. Yeah. And the movie did not do well. I mean, it had Brad Pitt. It had
Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie.
Angelina Jolie, yeah. And so I think, you know, seeing movies like that, it's like names. But what I realized is that names and festivals are very similar in the way that that is how distributors know best how to sell a film. And so if you come to a distributor with, hey, we don't have a name or festival laurels, but we've got these other marketable things. While they might agree with you that those things are marketable, it doesn't fit their system of here's where we put, you know, here's where we insert the name into our trailer. Here's where we put the name on our poster. You know, they have to put a lot more legwork into, okay, how do we put these marketable aspects into our framework of how we distribute films? Mm-hmm. And so I think that was the one difficulty when it came to festivals was people were surprised when they watched the movie. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard this, and I'm going to hear it 100 times again. But people go, "Oh, that was a lot better than I thought it would be." And you know, whether they're giving it a 6 out of 10 or an 8 out of 10 or a 9 out of 10, they came into it expecting 3 or 4 out of 10 because it didn't have a laurel on it. Mm-hmm. And I kind of have to be like, "Oh no, we didn't want to forefront the laurels because that's not our audience." And that boggled people's minds. They were like, "What do you mean you didn't do film? What do you mean you didn't do the festival circuit? You know, yada yada yada." And it's just a new way of thinking, and it's a much more difficult one to pull off. But you know better than anybody.
Yeah, no,
not necessary.
Agreed. And festivals aren't necessary, and they're nice. And if you've never done the experience, it's a great experience. You meet a lot of cool people. You meet a lot of filmmakers. You know, you might get a little press. You might get an award or two. Your ego might get stroked. You might get a red carpet, some pictures, but that's essentially it. Even if you get into one of these big ones, it's no guarantee. I know many filmmakers who won Sundance and did nothing for their careers. You know, it all depends on the kind of project.
When I saw like Jim Cummings and Vanishing Angle and Thunder Road, when I saw Thunder Road, you know, get grand jury at South-by and play at Sundance and all these things, and then not take the deal with A24 or with any of these, you know, distributors that came calling and decided to self-distribute, that's when I was kind of like, wait a second, if you know, grand jury at South-by and huge grassroots indie audience doesn't get you the deal you want, you know, I then there's no way that they're going to come calling for a football faith film, you know, like that. That's just not on the radar whatsoever.
Right. And but it's also like there's a lot of people who drank this Kool-Aid. A lot of filmmakers drink this Kool-Aid of this kind of myth of and expectations of what winning a festival does or how things should be. And I do believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe that a lot of these preconceived notions are myths of a long gone era, which are those 90s indie movies that, you know, that's kind of the beginning of the independent film movement, really. The independent film movie that we know today kind of started in the 90s, you know, started with if you want to go way back, Hollywood Shuffle, 1987, Robert Townsend. Uh-huh. And then you go – and then Sex, Lies, and Videotape with Steven Soderbergh, and then that launched Sundance and so on and so forth. And people still think that that's the way things are made. It is not. It is not that world anymore. And the world has changed so dramatically, and I'd love to have you on the show for this specific reason too, that you are a different model and a new model of what's happening. And you know what? This model might not work in a year or two. And we might have to switch again. You know, it could be another thing. So, but people got to get that out of their head, man. We're not living in 1990 anymore.
I'm going to inflate your ego here.
Oh, no, please.
Dangerous thing to do. that back alley in Hollywood might have an explosion.
Back alley in Hollywood.
That's what I really like about Indie Film Hustle. And the other podcasts that are in this space is it is to the day current when it comes to what does our industry look like, how is the best way to succeed today versus what worked 5 years ago. Because, I mean, it maybe in terms of the styles of movies 5 years ago can maybe be similar to now, but in the styles of distribution, it's just changing so fast that if you're not staying, like, you know, if you're not listening to Indie Film Hustle every week, you have lost track of what is happening in distribution and Indie Film Hustle and Creative Institute and all these other sources. I mean, it's so that's what, because, like, you know, books take time, and, you know, books used to teach you how to distribute a movie because information stayed the same for longer than 12 months.
Right.
And that was the same way with our camera gear too. We shot on the Canon C300 Mark II. We had the option to shoot red. It was the same price, just about. And the DP, Brian Tang, and I went into it, and I said, you know what, Brian, like, we're making a football movie. Our audience does not know the difference between red or Canon. They don't know the difference between anamorphics and spherical. I want to shoot this on the camera that is going to run for the longest amount of time without charging. That's going to take up, you know, a super low card space. And that isn't going to heat up if we take it outside in the Texas heat in May and die on us. And that's not going to kill my MacBook Pro when I go and, you know, do the first director's assembly and then hand it off to our editor who's on it. And this is, and as I say this, I realize you said this on an earlier episode of the podcast. You were talking about shooting on something that doesn't crash your computer.
It warms my heart. It really does warm my heart, man.
Are you having deja vu right now?
And of course, because it's basically everything I've ever preached. I'm like, guys, like, who cares? No one cares. Like, I shot my movie on a Blackmagic pocket camera, 1080p, you know, and it looks fantastic projected. You know, it's like, God, geez, this is just, you mean, I don't know. It's too much. I can't take this. I can't take it. It's too much. It's too much.
It's happening.
I'm literally exploding because I'm like, it warms the cockles of my heart to hear this from a filmmaker that I'm like, oh, good. Someone's listening out there to me. And it's not all about ego, and it's not all about, I need to shoot this on a Red or an Alexa. I'm like, no, man, my audience can't tell the difference. They both look really damn good. And what's gonna run the longest? What's not gonna crash my laptop when I'm working on it? What's gonna give me best bang for your buck, man? It's not always like I tell people. It's like, could I have shot Ego and Desire on an Alexa? Sure. Did I have access to one? Yeah, I could have probably gotten one if I wanted to, and I could have probably gotten away with shooting it all there if I truly wanted to. Is the Blackmagic Pocket Camera the best camera in the world? No. But does it work? And does it do exactly what I needed to do for that specific project? Absolutely.
And that's something that I've even got an image for it, and it's sort of the audience's threshold of quality. And it's, don't think about what your cinephile friends know about film. They're going to see the lens flare. They're going to see the yep. piece of production design that's messed up. Yep. Think about mom and pop. Think about Uncle Joe. What will they notice and not notice? And I'll tell you what they notice is bad directing, bad writing,
sound.
And bad sound. And so I think the hard thing to accept here is if you as a filmmaker are focusing too much on Red versus Alexa, and this is something I see on that Facebook group Movie Set Memes all the time. If you're focusing so much on Red versus Alexa, maybe it's because you don't know enough about what you should be focusing on to focus on that instead. And so again, it's go take a class, be a better director, be a better writer to the point where you don't feel like, because I had this phase. I mean, so strongly for such a long time, it was, I don't know how to make this any better. So maybe I can make it look better.
And yes.
As a director, that's not what you're there to do. You are there to make what's on screen better. Your cinematographer will make it look amazing.
If you hire a good one. Absolutely.
Well, I did. Brian.
Yes. No, it looks great. It looks great. I have to say it looks great. Thanks. Now, what was the distribution deal structure that you set up here? Because I'm really curious to see what kind of deal you got. And you said you would be more than willing to share this with the tribe.
So I'll share all of the publicly available, you know, info just so I'm not, you know, stepping on any toes. We're doing we've done a day and date release. So we blasted in 10 theaters, that, cost us some money up front, or the distributor at least put some money up front for that. And what it allowed us to do was to debut in theaters now folder, to debut it at a slightly higher premium price than elsewhere. It helps us with airlines and with later windowing and international sales and things like that to show that, you know, the distributor had enough confidence in the film to invest early in it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of in, you know, it's kind of in a similar way where it's like, oh, you didn't have a star, but they put it in theater. So it must be worth something. You know, mm-hmm. they spent money on it. So it must be worth something. So the day and date release is kind of the way that the distribution was structured. We're working on a very standard distribution deal. There's a distribution cut up front, and then there's a recoupment of expenses. And then there's our take after that.
If the expenses have been capped.
Yes.
Thank you.
So yes, you're welcome. That actually came from a friend who had gone through a very sad, very unfortunate distribution scenario. I'm sure you've never heard of that happening.
Never. Shocking.
And he kind of told me, he's like, you know, when it comes to deals, sometimes and usually the cap will be what they're going to spend. You know,
of course.
And so I kind of went into it knowing that, and you know, we're still waiting for, I've been very pleased with how they've distributed, and I think they've done a great job. And so I'm actually not in the school where I'm like, oh, they're totally going to screw us over. And I'm thrilled to be there. I'm thrilled that I think we found a good one. You know, I think we definitely didn't find a bad one. And when I get all the numbers, I'll be sure to come back to you, or, you know, go to the Creative Institute and share as much as the distributor's comfortable with me sharing, because I think in a world with so many bad distributors, it's worth, you know, really praising the good ones and praising mm-hmm. the ones that do good work, because you want them to be in high demand, and I definitely want that for ours if that's the way that it turns out. But
awesome, and then also you've gotten a streaming service deal as well. You got one of the big streaming service deals got picked up by one of them as well.
Yeah, and so I, you know, can't talk much about who it is or what
it is. It's one of the big boys.
One of the handful. What we noticed was, or what another one of the blueprint aspects that I looked at with this movie is, I was on an airplane, as many of us are from time to time, And I started to look at what was in their content library. And they had the film festival winners. They had, you know, the big Hollywood movies. They had this and that. And then I go clink, 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 go all the way down to the bottom. And they've got sports. And there's one sports movie. And it's the only category. It's the Blue Ocean. And it's like, oh, my God. They have, you know, like, name a sports movie that came out this year. Free Solo? You know, it's kind of like.
That's pretty much it. I mean, I don't, there's not, yeah.
That's all that's on iTunes right now, you know. And, well, RIP iTunes. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I saw that Blue Ocean. And I said, and so then I went to the streaming sites after that. And I started to look up, okay, who's been selling to these streaming sites? Who's buying what? And then the most important thing for me was, is there a big, you know, sports property that's recently left or taken a better deal with a different streaming site? Because what they like to do is, if they can't have James Bond, they'll put The Man from U.N.C.L.E. front and center. That way, if they have a customer that says, "I love spy movies, I want to go see James Bond," they can be like, "No, no, no, wait, stay with us, watch Man from U.N.C.L.E." You know, and I'm not even sure if that's on a streaming site, but if I was running one, that would be what I would put up to get to keep people to stay.
Mm-hmm. That's what Netflix does when you like search a specific like Marvel movie, they'll put all the other Marvel movies that they might have access to, but it might not be the one that you're looking for.
Right. And so, yeah, whether it's Netflix, whether it's Hulu, whether it's Crackle, whether it's any of them, it's sort of that industry that used to exist of the mockbusters, of, you know, the ones where
The Adventures of the Aladdin Mysteries or something like that. Like, it literally just came out like a week ago. I'm like, oh, yeah, there's that company. I forgot what they do, but that's all they do. It's just whatever the big Hollywood movie is, they'll pop it out.
It used to be very easy because you'd go to Blockbuster, and maybe Blockbuster didn't have the sleeve for Avengers, and they didn't have the sleeve for Adventures of Aladdin. You send Uncle Joe to Blockbuster, he brings home Adventures of Aladdin, and you don't watch it, but they've already made their money. Yep. And so that's where it started. And then, of course, now it's in full effect because you can design a poster that looks exactly like – I mean, to be fair, there's that meme. The Aladdin poster looks just like the Force Awakens poster. I mean, you know, the blue and the red. And
oh, yeah. I thought Thor – like when Avengers – like Thor Ragnarok came out, they just came out with a Thor movie. And it's just Thor Adventures or something like that. And because Thor, you can say Thor is Thor. It's
yes.
Yeah, no trademark on Thor.
There's no trademark. Yeah, there's no trademark there. So I think that was I was trying to look for a blue ocean in a streaming site.
So smart.
And I think that was definitely one of the major reasons behind why the one that picked us did. Mm-hmm. I'll take this time to say too, please go find Last Whistle on iTunes. Please go find us on Amazon or Xbox or wherever you can find us right now. Because we really need the tribe. We desperately need the tribe because we got to get those numbers up. It's all about the algorithm. It's all about, you know, mm-hmm. getting word out about the movie and that helps us. So I don't know when the whole streaming thing is going to come to fruition. So please don't hold out for that. Please go check the movie out. Just rent it for, you know, whether it's $3 or $5 or whatever it is, you know, mm-hmm. rent it. I will send you $1, $2, whatever you need to feel better about your purchase. But we really need the tribe to help us out right now. That's huge.
Yeah. Now, how did you get the word out on the film, or how are you getting the word out on the film?
Sort of going back to that blueprint. The blueprint has a bunch of different things that allow sort of give us an in. So we started with Fort Worth, where we filmed it. We're working with all of the people that helped us film there. We're sending them posters and trying to say, hey, you know, get people to like this. It's a very much a Facebook-based campaign because our audience demographic is older,
Snapchat.
But they're not as young as Snapchat or Instagram, which is better for us because I think while Facebook pages has its drawback, it's made a very nice platform for the generation that we're trying to reach. And because they are very active on, and I know they're active because Facebook is my favorite. You know, I'm an old soul at heart. You know, I don't, the newfangled things are not.
The newfangled things.
Fang, there it is, fang. Yeah, the newfangled
things. Listen to you. You're talking like you're my age.
Yeah. What are you? 29?
God bless you. God bless you, sir. God bless you.
And then boom, the head explodes.
Then the head explodes. Yeah, God bless you. You think I'm 29. My God, I
know how old you are.
Oh my God, can you imagine the damage I could do if I was in my 20s? Oh my God, with my mind today. Oh my God, the damage.
The mob would shoot a movie for you.
Yes, exactly. The mob would shoot a movie for me at this point. cool, man. Now, another thing I wanted to ask you real quickly is the business model you're trying to build here. You're trying to build – this is not a one-off. You're trying to do multiple films like this, and you're actually through your production company, through what you're trying to do, you're trying to build a business model that you can replicate on film after film after film so you could actually, God forsake, make a living in this business. You mean you're going to survive and thrive in this business? Please explain to people what you're trying to do.
Make a living. That's real. Oh, interesting. That's very interesting. That's a great idea. That would be,
isn't it? It would be great.
Very admirable idea. the whole goal with this movie is it's not about this movie. It's about the next one. Because while making that first movie is hard, once you do it, the hardest thing becomes the next one. And that's what I've heard from everyone that's gone and done their first feature. You know, I told you, I called up all the directors who had just done their first feature who, you know, were super helpful. And one of them was Morgan Dameron, who you recognize that name because it's Poe Dameron, his last name from Star Wars. And she was assistant to J.J. Abrams for a number of years. And she left Bad Robot and went and did her first feature. And she was hugely helpful to us in making –
that's awesome.
Last Whistle, because she would stay on the phone with me for hour and a half, just giving me all the things. She was like, listen, you're going to have to do a dialogue continuity and spotting list, and it's hell, but it's going to be worth it. And she was very happy with Jason at Distributor, and they went with Distributor, and they self-distributed, and their movie's called Different Flowers. So they're awesome. That's one definitely worth checking out. And she was one of those people who's very transparent with me and gave me a lot of info. And as we ended the call, this was about, you know, a year and a half ago, I was like, what's going on now? And she's like, well, the hardest thing is that second feature. And so that almost planted a seed for me back then where it's like, oh, that's crazy that, you know, they did such a good job with this movie and it's still so hard to get that second feature. I know that she will. And I at this point she's doing TV and commercials and she's doing fine. I mean, she's doing great. But that's been my mindset this whole time is, okay, how do you get that second feature? And so that's the whole idea is let's figure out a business model where we're not overextending anybody, where we're not going to burn any bridges, where we're never going to lose everyone's money, and where we really give the opportunity to really blow up. And if it's not the Last Whistle that blows up, say the Last Whistle goes and does our medium range expectations, then, you know, we're still kind of ahead of the pack there. We're still kind of like, oh, wait a second. We can take this to someone that wants to make a 5% return on investment or wants to lose 10% of an investment and be an executive producer on a movie and say, hey, here are the numbers. Here's what we can and can't do. This movie is almost there so I can just have numbers. So I can just, you know, take numbers.
Proof of concept. It's a proof of concept.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And so you know, as we go into our next movie, I think I'm gonna go. I wasn't sure if I was gonna do this. I don't know if it's where I'll be, you know, 3 months from now. But I think for the next film, I want to do what we did with Last Whistle in the faith realm. I think that Last Whistle is very much a football movie with a very heavy art house structure to it. Even though you wouldn't really know that, you know, you wouldn't think about that going into it, basically. But it's – I really tried to bring some very classic filmmaking style into this movie. And I think it's totally all under the surface. I don't think anyone really notices it. But I think that just like Kubrick did with 2001 A Space Odyssey, where he brought sci-fi from this sort of like B-movie realm into, oh, adults can watch science fiction. Mm-hmm. I think I'd like to, and I think it's been done before a few times, but I think I'd like to bring that to the faith film perspective because it's a realm where I feel comfortable telling an investor, we've got an audience here, a worldwide audience that is worth this amount of money every year, and if we carve out this niche, then I think we can spend this much on the movie, you know, and just totally reverse engineer it that way, and just work my way up in terms of budget level sizes until, you know, I've either had one do a great job or I've worked my way up enough to where, you know, maybe I don't have to produce my own stuff anymore, and I can kind of, you know, go be a director somewhere or go be a writer somewhere and you know, produce whatever I want. That's kind of the game plan.
The dream. Now, you wrote a book as well.
I did. I'd gotten so many questions that were so similar so many times while making the movie. And you know, one of the most common, of course, which is how did you raise the money and that sort of thing. And I got to the point where I had I started to say different answers every time. And then I would say like the worst possible answer when I had definitely said the best possible answer in the past. Mm-hmm. And so at that point I was like, you know what? I'm just going to write down all my answers. I want to have this in like a place where I can go like literally flip to it and figure out, oh wait, what is my answer to this? What is the best answer I've ever answered for this? Because I didn't want to answer the bad answer anymore. And so I did a book. I got it right here. Rebel with a Crew. I call it Rebel with a Crew instead mm-hmm. of Rebel without a Crew, because the thesis of the book is that the Robert Rodriguez movie, The El Mariachi, doesn't really exist anymore in a way that built a career.
His model was very specific to him.
Very much so. And it's what you've talked about, where it's like, yeah, for every, you know, Kevin Smith and for every Robert Rodriguez, there's, you know, X number of people that did the same thing and, you know, didn't have that person show up at their screening and yada, yada, yada. But the thesis with Rebel with a Crew is that if you've got a group of people around you, mm-hmm. A bunch of, you know, if 10 Robert Rodriguez's get in a room, that they can do, they can achieve that, you know, whether it's 10, whether it's 5, whether it's 2. My thesis is the idea that the quality of films has gotten so good that you need help if you want to compete at the minimal level. Mm-hmm. And whether that's, you know, actors or a sound person or whatever it is, that's the idea of having that crew. And that was the whole idea with just upping the production value with Last Whistle. You know, Last Whistle wouldn't have been possible if we didn't have amazing cinematography, amazing sound, amazing acting. My brother's helping me wrangle extras, a whole city of people coming out for one night to be a crowd at a football game. You know, killer scheduling, killer composition. And I'm forgetting 10, 15 other people there, but it's all about the book is all about that crew. And it's all about just going through every step of the process, from writing to directing to casting to, you know, all the pieces that. That you normally would ask about. And then I've got chapters on distribution and marketing too, but those aren't done yet because I don't have the numbers yet. And so it's out on Amazon. It's called Rebel with the Crew. And check it out. It's like half a book right now. And so I'm selling it for like a half a book price because it is definitely not finished yet. But it's got enough information to at least, you know, do everything we've talked about going to the distributor beforehand and budgeting and keeping your costs. And all that
That's
stuff.
Awesome. That's awesome, dude. Now I am going to ask you the questions I ask all of my guests. So you should.
And for once, you got someone that's prepared for it.
Maybe there's one. Maybe a new one in there. There might be a new one in there. I don't know. We'll see. No. We'll see. We'll see. All right. What advice would you give a filmmaker wanting to break into the business today?
I had to think about this. This is the hardest one for me to answer. I did have to think about this one long and hard. And I actually forgot that you asked about this one until recently. And then when I heard you ask it, I was like, oh wait, I don't know the answer to that one. I think my advice would be very bird's eye view. Hollywood cannot ignore someone who's making a profit.
Yes, very true. Very, very true.
So if you have an idea or something that can make money, you are 100% getting into Hollywood if you're making money.
Again and again, even more so.
Yes. Agents will line out the door to take 10% of that money. You know, it's totally the most foolproof way. Now, you know, obviously the idea to do that is hard and it might be, you know, you might not have that answer yet. But if you can find that answer, it could save you a lot of failure time.
Now, can you tell me the book that had the biggest impact in your life or career?
Kind of the brother to Red Ocean, Blue Ocean, Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers.
Yeah, great book. I love that book.
Great book. And I love the way that that book talks about success as failure, you know, which is very easy. You know, that's a very common idea, but you don't see it like he talks about it in very, you know, concrete ways. He talks about really just, you know, the people that walked backwards while everybody else was walking forwards, and just how to really, you know, apply those mantras that you hear on, you know, inspirational quotes where it's like, don't do what everybody else does. Whereas, you know, I really like the way that, you know, MG takes it and he's like, no, here's where someone didn't do what everybody else did. And here's why it doesn't matter. You know, here's why it doesn't sound like it does on those inspirational things. So. Outlier. Cool. Also, David and Goliath. David and Goliath
That's another great book. Now, what lesson took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Okay, so this one for me is that a larger number of people than I expected are not good at their jobs, and it's not because they lack the skill; it's because they lack the hustle.
That's a good answer.
And whether it's your job or whether it's, you know, someone at the quote unquote Harvard of film schools that's, you know, just cruising their way through. I think I'm always surprised by anyone in any profession who is just there because they have to be. And I think that the lesson that took me the longest to learn there was just that there are lots of people that feel that way. And so.
Okay. Good answer.
Like the tribe is motivated.
What is the biggest fear you had to overcome with making this film?
There's the new one. Got me. Okay. All right. I'm going to have to get – yeah, I'm going to have to give you a second on that one. Total financial loss.
Okay. It's a very reasonable fear.
You know – And that, you know, in the beginning, it took the form of, oh, we only shot half the footage and we're out of money, you know. Now it takes the form of, all right, what are the numbers going to look like? Or, you know, is the cap going to work, you know, and think, you know, that sort of thing. But my biggest fear was having to go back to the investors and say, we lost all the money. Because I want to go back and tell them that we made their money back. I want to tell them that we made them all a penny. You know, that would be success. So my fear was a goose egg.
Three of your favorite films of all time, sir?
Star Wars. Mm-hmm. A New Hope, as I, you know, came up knowing it. And A New Hope wasn't my favorite Star War. But it became that when I saw the making of Star Wars, the documentary. And I saw just what a trial it was
for
Gary and for all those people, you know, going through the desert and all that. So Star Wars became my favorite movie because it was just such a challenge for them to make.
Okay.
So I guess number two would be Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
I see a theme growing. Go ahead.
Yes. And then the third one would be Back to the Future Part 3.
Yep. It was all Spielberg touched.
Yeah.
So it's Part 3 you like the best.
Yeah, and I got flack for that in film school.
Really? Part 3? Interesting, because I actually – Part 3 is probably my second. My first – I love number 1. I love number 3, and then I love number 2, the last. Yeah. And number 2 is just congenitive tissue that you need to get to 3 and has its own fun parts about it. But 3 is actually really fun. I love 3.
So I think 3 – so I love Westerns.
Yeah.
I think, but as a kid, you know, growing up and I was the oldest child. And so they tried to shelter me the most, you know, I got three little brothers, they're maniacs. Shout out to them. Big help on the movie, but they're three little brothers, they're maniacs. But I was the sheltered one. I was the one where they were like, you know, we need to make sure he's not getting no violence, no drugs, no, you know, and to be fair, I haven't given into the drugs. Like I'm drug free right now, but
the night is young, sir. The night is young. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm going to have mom tune out right now. Thank you. But I think that I've just got this part of me that just loves the old West. And when it comes to showing, you know, an 8-year-old, a Western, you can't do that, but Dad will always want to show an 8-year-old Back to the Future.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think Back to the Future Part 3 was my first Western, and that's why it's my favorite, is because, you know, this pastiche of years of spaghetti Westerns was actually my first one. And by the time I saw a Clint Eastwood film, you know, in my teens, I was like, oh, the iron on his chest. I got it. Okay. I see what this is. He's making a reference.
Exactly. I guess reverse engineered the Western for yourself.
It's the name of the game.
And now where can people find you and your work?
Sure. My handle for all my social media is Mad Smatter. That was a nickname that somebody came up for me in high school. But if you just Google Rob Smatt, there's only one of me. I'm not smart. That's the tag. There it is. Now you'll never forget that. There's only one of me. And then, The Last Whistle is available on all digital platforms. You know, whatever's easiest for you, go check it out. Please give us a click. Even if it's just a little rent, a little rental means the world to us. And check me out. I'm everywhere, and hopefully I'll keep going after this.
You are a unique snowflake, sir, as all of us are.
as a millennial.
As a disenfranchised millennial, you are.
I know.
Rob, man, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on your show, man. Thank you for dropping some serious knowledge bombs on the tribe today, man. Thanks so much.
You got it.
Thank you, Rob, for coming on the show and paying it forward and sharing what you have learned on your filmmaking journey. I truly, truly appreciate it. If you want links to his movie, The Last Whistle, or want to get in contact with Rob, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/348. And also want to give you guys another update. I have finally finished writing my new book, Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. It is now in the hands of my book editor, and we hopefully will be releasing it sometime late October, if not early November. So right now on Amazon, it says October 8th. That will change, but I can't tell you how proud I am of this book. It is a nuclear bomb going off in the film business. That's what I really hope it will be for anybody reading this book. I hope it begins and starts the movement of changing the way filmmakers think about making their movies, how to become more entrepreneurial, and how to create a real business around your art form. So if you do want to get a pre-order of the book, head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Sign up for early access. And I hope you guys really find some value in it. It is something I'm extremely, extremely proud of. And as I promised before, I will be asking you almost every episode to please share this show with 5 of your filmmaking friends, 5 people that you think that will find value in what I do here at the podcast, the websites, or any of the other companies, Filmtrepreneur, Bulletproof Screenwriting, whichever you think they can find value of, share it with 5 of your friends so we can spread this information and this message to as many filmmakers and screenwriters as humanly possible. Thank you guys again so much for listening. I hope I've been of value to you today on your filmmaking journey. As always, keep that hustle going, keep that dream alive, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's indiefilmhustle.com.